With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Our Shelves, a podcast where writers from the legendary feminist publishing house Virago talk about their cultural worlds. We'll be diving into these writers' bookshelves, record collections, and recollections to discover what inspires them. I'm Lucy Scholes, and my guest today is Claire Roshetsky. Welcome to Our Shelves, Claire. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Lucy.
Claire Roshetsky is a novelist whose short fiction has appeared in numerous reviews and anthologies, and she has also written articles for Wired, Salon, and the New York Times. Her novel, Chouette, has just been published by Virago. Claire, I want to begin by talking about Chouette. It is an extraordinary novel, something unlike anything that I can think of reading before. So I'd love it if you could maybe give our listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read it a little bit of an introduction.
Chouette is what I almost like to think of as a memoir of my experiences of motherhood. I am the mother of two, what I like to call non-conforming children. They had trouble integrating into schools, and my younger child in particular used to behave in ways that sometimes frightened her teachers. And I found motherhood very different from what I expected. With both children, they were born at home, and I was like, cool, I went back to work. They were born in the morning, very conveniently, and I went back to work in the afternoon. I was a freelance journalist.
And wow.
Sort of felt like I got this. I'm warrior mom. But those kids did not cooperate. They needed a full-time mom. And it was really quite an unusual and disorienting truth for me to understand that some children need more. They need a full-time person there to be their champion. And I wrote about it while it was happening, but what I wrote was kind of self-serving and angry because I didn't expect to need to do that job. And then I realized this is the work of my life, and kind of threw myself into being a full-time mom. And the book itself, I wrote after things settled down a little bit. My children grew up and are very independent now. And it's really looking back in a deep way, a deeply felt way for me at the story of a mother who is disoriented and upended by a very unusual child, what I call an owl baby in the book. And I would like to add that my daughter was my primary consultant for the book, and it became a wonderful bonding experience for us both that she shared her memories and we talked about it as I was writing. So it's been a great experience for us both to see the book come to be published.
That's a wonderful sort of story about this kind of collaborative process that you had with her. Well, I mean, you're the one doing the writing, but you, and I think in the copy that I've got, you do say at the back that however surreal Chouette feels to us both like our shared true story. That's a beautiful way of describing it.
That's how it felt. And just to give one example of how she helped me, my daughter is a musician now and is very prolific and very knowledgeable about music in a way that I'm not. And so I made music a big part of the novel, and she advised me about how to approach that. There's a lot of specific musical pieces identified in the piece in the novel. And these were things that she mostly chose for a certain scene, and some things I put in and she said, no, that doesn't fit. And so I took them out, and that was lovely to share that way too.
That's really interesting. Did you tell me a little bit more about how you went about that? Did you go to her with certain scenes and say, what I need is a sort of piece of music that will fit this scene? Or did you ask her to sort of just give you examples and then you would listen to them and think, what works here, what doesn't work?
Well, she was almost in an editorial role. So I would put something in and she'd say, no, this is incorrect for these reasons. So I'd have to like work harder. So she didn't do the work for me, but she was sort of my guide through a musical landscape that made sense. My editor at Virago had the idea of making a playlist, and there is a playlist now on Spotify that accompanies the book.
Oh, how wonderful. Well, if readers haven't listened to that already, it's up there waiting for you. Can I just go back briefly then to what you were saying a bit about memoir? Because I'm really curious about this idea that you started writing something that was, you know, very much based on your own experiences, but what was the problem with it, writing it as a sort of straightforward memoir? Were you too close to your material?
I couldn't really, I think I was at arm's length, actually, because there's issues of privacy. I'm writing about my children.
Yeah.
And I had opinions that maybe they don't share, or obviously I made big mistakes that probably I don't recognize because I'm like doing my best, and I'm sure they would have their own idea of what happened when we were going through this life experience together, of them growing up and being different. So I didn't feel like it was my story to tell. It just felt like if I were to say it in my words, I'd have to be very cognizant of their privacy. And it was getting in the way of saying what was true. And as soon as I leapt into this more fictional, fantastic world, it felt very viscerally true to me. Like, yes, this is exactly what it was like. And it's kind of weird. I mean, I will acknowledge that it's weird because the book itself is very surreal. The mother in the book is raising an owl baby. The baby is a hunter and eats raw animals at some points, and obviously doesn't fit in preschool because of this. So, but for me, it felt like, oh yeah, this is the way it was to be mother to my children.
Mm. Well, the emotional intensity was the truthfulness, right? This was a way in which you could talk about what it felt, it felt to me like a very honest depiction of what motherhood felt like, even if this is not, you didn't raise an actual owl baby, that's sort of beside the point, right?
Yes, that's how I felt. And by wrapping it in this fictional world, this very fantastic world, I could be very honest without worrying about anyone's true story, who was actually living it with me.
Yeah. I also, there is something I very much admired about it and found fascinating, was the sort of violence of motherhood that you really go into here. That obviously you are talking about, you know, we're talking about an owl baby, we're not talking about a real baby, but there is a kind of this sort of feral, very kind of raw state of being that your mother, Tiny, the fictional mother, goes into in the existence with her, with Chouette, with her owl baby. And there's that wonderful line at some point where she says that birthing a child is a lifelong terrorization by the very child that we love. And I found that so evocative because I think that, again, it's something that really strikes true to, I imagine, quite a lot of mothers' experiences.
I hope so. I think even if you have the most easygoing baby around, there is some moment, particularly in your early experiences, your first experiences of motherhood, where you are at a loss. And this creature who is completely dependent on you is unreachable, or just won't let you sleep, or is completely dependent on you and completely unable to take care of itself. And it's up to you to figure that out. And for some, I think every mother has some moments. They might be right at the beginning and just last a few days, or it might be the child won't sleep for a year and you need to deal with that. And there's like nothing you can do except give and yield and be there. And so I'm hoping that even people who don't have children can relate, that you might have had a sibling that was of a challenge that you felt affected the family, or you have taken care of a parent that was at times unreachable or very difficult to deal with because of health or mental health issues. So that helplessness and yet complete responsibility of taking care of someone is what I really wanted to have be the heart of the book.
Well, I think you've done that excellently. It is I read it very much as a novel about looking after other people, not just, motherhood is just one example of that, obviously, but there are, like you say, there are so many other examples, so it can resonate with many, many, many different readers. Let's go into our main questions. And I think some of your answers are really interesting because I think they resonate with your own work in kind of fascinating ways. So first up, please, Claire, tell me about a book. I think you've got two books that are currently on your bedside table that you'd like to talk about.
Yes, I really love a novel by a Belgian author, Adeline Dieudonné, called Real Life in English. It was translated by Roland Glasser. And I recently led a discussion about this book that was a lot of fun because the book itself has a child protagonist, which it's kind of a favorite kind of book for me, who is slightly feral slightly on her own at an age where she shouldn't be. And additionally experiences early in life, death of someone that she feels responsible for, that she caused it. And the book is a fascinating look at a child's experience of a very uncertain, chaotic world and trying to survive through it. We had a lot of fun talking about this book because it brings up for me something as a writer that was of interest, is how fiction can slip between the real and the fantastic. I mean, of course, it's all made up. It's fiction, but taking that fictional world into things that are obviously impossible. I think that Dieudonné does that very well. And yet for some people, it's too much. It was like, well, I can't believe that this child could carry an elephant tusk, because elephant tusks are very big. And so they'd be very like viscerally real in their reactions. And that's just a fascinating question to me as a reader, like how some things people buy into and other things people are like, no, I can't believe that, even though it's all fictional. So it's fun to read. It sort of touched things that I really like in other books. Barbara Comans writes a lot about children like this, and I love all of her novels. So
I loved it when you told me you were going to discuss this novel, and you said, if you haven't read it already, I think you'll like it, because it is there are sort of interesting similarities with Barbara Comans' work, and you were so right. It was right up my street as well. I have a thing for those. I think, like you say, these child protagonists that are sort of out of their depth in a strange world, and the way that it becomes almost, you know, it's a sort of dark fairy tale, right? These kind of strange real world fairy tales that just hit slightly off kilter. And I think that slightly off kilterness is partly because a child's eye view of the world, especially with the kind of evil, with the kind of terrible things happening in it, is always slightly off kilter anyway, right?
Exactly. It's real to the protagonist. And somehow this author has allowed us to enter into that naive, terrifying sometimes viewpoint of a child. And the book it reminded me of most was The Vet's Daughter by Barbara Comans. And what I liked was that both, having read both of them, I realized they both have a daughter who despises their mother for not protecting them from an abusive father. And yes, they both use animal references to their mothers. And I started thinking about that would be true, that there's this element of a father being abusive, and that the child would blame the mother. And it really hit me after reading both of them that they were using animalistic descriptions of their mother, and they really disdain their mother for allowing herself to be abused. And in some ways I found that enlightening to the whole idea of a dysfunctional family.
Yes, I think I also, the Vet's Daughter as well, the descriptions of the mother in that are so visceral. The father as well, he treats the mother like an animal, doesn't he?
That's
so it sort of encourages the daughter to think about her like that, and she becomes another sort of sick person or sick being in this house, right? Like the animals around her. And so it's incredibly claustrophobic and kind of horrific. And something similar does happen in real life. They're astonishing books. I'd be very interested to know if the writer of real life had read Barbara Comings at any point. I don't know whether she's in translation at the moment. It'd be interesting to find out.
Yes, I would be interested too. Dieudonné in real life calls her mother an amoeba. So she's like moving further down the chain of animal.
Yeah, I'd forgotten about that. But of course, this amoeba who doesn't do anything. She hasn't got an identity even in the house, does she? She does so little to either to protect the children or to kind of help them, or to there's a kind of blankness there where there should be a real presence, right?
That's right. I also love this novel for its contrast with The Discomfort of Evening by Marika Lucas Reinfeldt. I don't know. I believe that won the Booker International Prize, that book. And it has the same theme of a child feeling responsible for a death. And they came out within weeks of each other. So it was an interesting contrast to me, where one is very relentless, that there's no redemptive feeling. And on the other hand, Real Life by Dieudonné has this kind of plucky, I'm going to survive this feeling. And they just were very different in ways that attracted me.
Yeah, no, I think that was the other book that I thought about when I was reading it. And I always find it fascinating when books that are kind of similar in interesting ways that get published within such a short period, you know, so close to one another, and one of them perhaps gets more attention than the other. And then why is that? What was it about this one book that really resonated with readers, and then the other that's kind of gone under the radar slightly by comparison? It's always, I don't think one doesn't necessarily always find out, but if people did enjoy The Discomfort of Evening, I think they would very much enjoy Real Life.
I also chose Against White Feminism, Notes on Disruption by Rafia Zakaria. And this book has such a kind of aggressive title, Against White Feminism, but I found it very inclusive and just thoughtful in ways that I was ready to have thoughts about, where Zakaria is defining white feminism is as not just white people's feminism, but as a way of structuring the goals of feminism to mirror success, or the idea of success that's very much in line with white male success and white Western culture's ideas of success. And she points out that not everyone can be president of a company, and we need to deal with structural elements as well. And the thing that really hit me was her analysis of the war in Afghanistan and how, for the first time, really, the government of the United States, which was a conservative government at the time, aligned itself with feminist goals in a very kind of direct way, and that the war was about freeing women who were oppressed. I think that Zakaria does a good job pointing out that bombing people is not necessarily a good way to, even if you build a school later, that it's not necessarily the best way to allow women to grow as equal individuals within their culture. And indeed, the way that effort has collapsed in the last few months after 20 years, I think proves her point. So I enjoyed it and I recommend it.
I'm really interested what you said at the beginning of that you were you said that you were ready to hear this, that you're ready to read this book, ready to hear the things in it. What did you mean by that?
Well, I've mentioned that I spent most of my adult life in this caregiving role while kind of disparaging it in my own head, like, oh, I'm kind of a failure, and definitely a failure as a feminist. Here I am in this very traditional role. I'm not making money. So, it allowed me to reflect back on that and realize that many of women's experiences are excluded from the idea of feminism as I thought of it. And thinking about how, well, it's a very big topic, how culture has really formed my idea of success to be something that is competitive with other women, or that allows me to judge other women or to feel superior to other women more than feeling like they have something to teach me. She has a wonderful part right at the beginning of the book where she talks about the words resilience versus resistance, and that there's something to be learned from women who are working within a structure that is oppressive and finding a way through through traditional cultures that they're a part of to affect change, and that is often a kind of change that's more long lasting than something coming from outside, like buying a woman a chicken so they can start a farm, or you know, these things that are very Western oriented in terms of economies. So I had to listen, and also I think that as an author, Zakaria is not saying, wait a minute, what about us? She's saying, hey, you feminists that think that this idea of having a big career and making a lot of money is the way to be successful, come here and listen to what we have to say. And in that way, I found it enlightening.
Put very brilliantly. Next up, Claire, I think you're going to tell me about a recent film that's made you think.
Yes, I chose Lingua Franca, directed by and written by Isabel Sandoval. And Sandoval is a trans woman from the Philippines, and she has written a story of an undocumented worker in Brooklyn who's coping with life during the Trump era. And one of the things I loved about the movie is it's kind of funny. People are calling it tender or quiet, but what it is it's written by a trans woman and does not rely on tropes of violence towards trans women or terrible things happen to trans women. It's like the threat is always there, but it doesn't happen. So one of the things I loved about it is there's a love scene that is so different from The Crying Game, which is like the man is just horrified by the lover's body as he comes to to understand that it's not what he expected. Whereas mm-hmm. in this movie, there's a love scene that is just a love scene, and it's amazing that way, and it really reflects on poverty, not just for undocumented workers, but her lover is a second generation Russian Jewish man who is an alcoholic, and he has a terrible job in a meat processing plant, and so the two of them are kind of giving me a look at a way of life that does not get enough attention in fiction or in film, I believe. And I really recommend the movie.
Sounds sort of strange saying it, doesn't it? But the idea that a sort of tender and quiet love story that doesn't shock or hasn't got all these kind of horrific elements of violence explicitly in it is somehow now maybe sort of a brave piece of filmmaking, because those aren't stories that we might see when we're talking about trans characters on screen.
Yes, I felt that way very much, Lucy, that it really took I've been kind of on the fence with this artistic thought of, well, trans people need to write trans stories and trans actors need to write be in trans roles. I mean, I believed it as a political statement, but then when I saw this film, I realized what we're missing by not allowing trans people to tell their stories freely, because it was just so much more nuanced and lovely and human than the shocker kind of trans stories we've been given in the past. And it was revelatory for me that way to see the film.
Arshel will be back in just a moment.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome back to Our Shelves. I'm Lucy Scholes, and I'm talking to Claire Olszewski about what we lose when we don't let trans people tell their own stories. Next up, Claire, I am going to ask you about a book that made you think about feminism in a new way. And I think your answer to this is fascinating, but I think it also maybe relates a little bit back to some of the things that you were talking about having learned with reading Against White Feminism. So tell me a bit about the book, first of all.
Yes, I chose The First Wife, A Tale of Polygamy by Paulina Ciciane, translated by David Brookshaw. It came out in 2016 in English, published by the U.S. Publisher Archipelago. And I'm not sure if it ever got into print in the UK. It is out of print now in the UK, and the publisher that had picked it up is no longer publishing.
You can definitely get the ebook, though, just to tell our listeners, because I read the ebook. Yeah, so people can
I'm so glad.
Yeah.
Well, so I I read this book first in 2016, and I write down what I think of books as soon as I finish reading them. And looking back, I wrote, oh, this is a universal story about feminism and the bringing together of women who might have been enemies in another context. It's a story of a woman who discovers that her husband has several other wives and legally or not treats them as other wives. And she brings them together. And as a group, they become very powerful and effect change together. And, you know, this is like very funny on some levels. It's just kind of ribald and lovely writing, and gave me a real sense of the writer. And I was ready to be like, oh, yeah, I get this. But I want to be more cautious now. You know, I've read it a few times since, and I realized that, Paulina Ciciane is about my age, and she's lived through 30 years of civil war. Mm. And I just want to read from the author bio. Paulina Ciciane was born in 1955 in an area of Mozambique in which communication with the white colonizers was forbidden. In her mid-20s, she devoted herself to writing and became the first Mozambican woman with a published novel. So here's these two things about her that I just realize I have no idea who she is and what she's gone through. I feel a connection with the book, but I also want to be very careful not to overstep and say, oh, yes, I understand, because there's so many layers in this book that I need to concede that I need to know more about Mozambican history. I need to understand the difference between North and South and how colonization has shaped the culture. And a lot of it is just out of my reach because Ciciane wrote in Portuguese. There's only one of her novels that has been published. And anything I find online, any written interviews, I have to laboriously put into Google Translate to see what she said, because I don't know Portuguese. So in a way, it's like my far frontier of what I don't know about feminism and about women in other cultures, even though I love the book.
Yeah, you say that you've read it a few times now. Does your impressions of it change with every reading in a kind of obvious way, or is it a sort of slow revelation of new elements in the novel?
Well, I've changed. I'm like, well, wait a minute. I cannot assume I understand what this book means, because the author is living a very different life, very different economy. When I think about the first woman to have published a novel, it's not just that she's female, but that it's so difficult to publish anything when a economy has different priorities or is in a civil war. So I have changed, and I'm more skeptical of my ability to understand. So in a very concrete way, the first scene, or among the first scenes, there's a sound, a loud sound. And the protagonist says, oh, a bomb. And it's like, I hadn't really thought about that in a concrete way, that you're living in a place where there's a lot of violence, growing up in a place where there's a lot of conflict, that every sound would affect your interpretation of your environment. So that's one way that I think the first time I just sort of la, and I was reading and I didn't really think about this author and her context in a way that I think I do now.
Mm. I read it in advance of speaking to you today, because you'd talked so you mentioned it so sort of eloquently and said how much it had meant to you, and I think, like you, yes, I wouldn't want to say that I understand it in any shape or form, but there was so much there that made me think, and particularly thinking about what you were talking about while reading Against White Feminism, there were elements in this novel that made me really sort of step back and think about my understanding of what feminism means to me as well, and like how I might the judgments I might make unconsciously or, you know, about other people's decisions about the way that they lead their lives and what I think of as being a feminist act or a non-feminist act. And particularly this, I don't know, with the, you talked briefly at the beginning about the women who bond together and they sort of become an incredible force by, in their sort of solidarity, right? So it's an incredibly sort of, I don't know, empowering feminist fable, like we want to call it a fable in the one hand, but yet at the same time, they're dealing with such kind of structural misogyny in the society, aren't they?
That's right. And it's, it just makes me thoughtful. I don't know if I have a judgment about it. Another way I've changed is some things I thought of as exaggeration, and now I'm not sure. I'm like, well, I need to be careful what I assume is, oh, that would never happen. So in that way, I feel less close to the book, but maybe closer to the idea. There's still this obvious feeling I have of, being a woman, there is a universal reality to that. And there is some foundational difference that is becoming more mysterious what that is, though, as trans women become part of the conversation and as different cultures become part of the conversation and are listened to with as we move out of our post-colonial phase. So I feel the bond with the author and with the characters, and yet I also want to feel respectful of the differences.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask about something that you mentioned briefly earlier? You said that those many of the years that you were caring for your children, you felt that you were not leading a particularly kind of feminist life and that you weren't out there making money. You weren't sort of, you know, you didn't have a kind of a very empowering kind of role in the workplace. So tell me a little bit about how feminism has sort of changed in the meaning, what it means to you over the years in your life.
I thought of it as an individual empowerment about me, about my success as an individual, and it quite apart from culture or expectation or family that I was important and my role, my success. That it was important to me to succeed. I have this great education and to be a prominent kind of successful person I was a freelance journalist at the time before I had children and to be in that role felt very important. And now I'm not sure. I think that feminism needs to possibly, come to terms with the fact that an individual contributor used to be just men were these successful individual pathfinders are supported by their entire community. Mm-hmm. And somebody needs to do that support work. And I don't know who it is, but I know it needs to be done. And I know it's still just not at all valued either economically or culturally. And I don't have an answer to that. But that was sort of the core question I was trying to grapple with Chouette, that this woman has to give up everything. And she does so reluctantly, but someone has to do that work. And it's true of any human situation. The person who succeeds has to be supported. I think about the Supreme Court and the most recent addition there, and everyone says, "Oh, she has 7 children," but she's not. She has to have support to have the ability. It's not that she's out there doing it all by herself. That was kind of a revelation to me. It was a big surprise that this other work still needs to be done. Someone needs to do it, and yeah, I don't know where I'm going with this. I don't have a lot of answers. I just know that this idea of being an individual who succeeds on her own is flawed. It needs reexamination, as does the idea of success itself, or what it means to be a successful human being.
I'm curious to know, did you find that when you found yourself in the role of caregiver and as a full-time caregiver to your children, were you very aware that other people around you were, for want of a better word, sort of looking down or judging that role compared to a sort of more high-powered, I don't know, career as a freelance journalist, if you can call that high-powered, but you know what I mean? did you notice a sort of a change in people's attitude to you, a change in respect? Was this something that was
absolutely clear? Absolutely. Yeah. Every time I was in a group and introduced with my husband, there would be like, you're uninteresting, you're not important, I'm going to talk to your husband. And and I had to keep reminding myself not to feel that way. Mm. And I still do. It's like, this is important work. This is important work. I had to talk myself into it. And sometimes I failed.
And coming out the other side, as it were, realizing now that you have more time to yourself, now that you're not a full-time caregiver in the same way, what does that feel like? Does that feel like a sort of, is it a mixture of freedom and do you miss it as well? Because surely it's a thing that kind of became very important to you and defined your sort of identity for quite a long period of time.
Well, I miss my children because they're amazing, and seeing them at each stage, even though they were very difficult for other people, I just adored their company and thought they were wonderful. So yes, that was wonderful and I miss it. But I need to align myself with other women out there who've been in this situation. Maybe when you get to the end of caregiving, you are completely scoured out and you're good for nothing, basically, because you've lost 15 years of your career to something that no one values, except possibly your children, not always. And you get to the end and it's like, what do I do now? And I had a terrible time of feeling completely useless. I'd go to job interviews and they'd be like, well, what have you been doing? Nothing. And why should we hire you? You don't seem very interesting. And I wrote a novel. I mean, that was nice to have this other kind of incredible thing happen that I'm now feeling like a human being again that has something to contribute. But I do think a lot about women. However, like now we've had COVID and who was taking care of those people who needed care at home and who still can't go back to their work full time, who is losing that income and that level of selfhood. Now it's mostly women.
Of course, because there was lots of talk, wasn't there, early on in the pandemic about how many women had given up work because they literally couldn't keep working and educate their children, or they were the first ones to be fired from the offices. So it's clearly hit a whole sort of generation of women.
That's right.
Yeah. And last up today, if I may, Claire, I'd like you to tell me about a woman or a person of an unrepresented gender whom you admire.
I chose Jan Morris, who died recently, and I hadn't really heard of her before reading a review of her posthumously published book, Allegorizings.
Interesting.
And I guess she's more well-known in the UK maybe than in the US.
Yeah, perhaps so. That's probably right, actually.
So I find her writing just incredibly elegant and genteel and kind is the first thing that really hit me about her. And then reading her short autobiography, Conundrum, that she wrote in 1974, I was just amazed by her perception of herself as a woman from the age of three. And she had this incredible life as a woman, and the way she... the way she felt inside was entirely female, and like she was wearing a costume almost that allowed her to go on these incredible adventures to climb Mount Everest with Sir Edmund Hillary and to be a foreign correspondent while always feeling like a woman. And the story of her transition just seems so, there's so much clarity in her identity that she just never wavers or feels like has a mental illness. She never questions her identity. So I just found it a wonderful thing to read. And of course, her histories, I love now that I've just read one of the trilogy, and just reminded me so much of Barbara Tuchman, who I thought was one of a kind. And then I have this other person who just loves to tell stories about people. And I've enjoyed those as well. And I guess I admire her for her kindness and her particular vision of herself as a woman that was unshakable, even with all this storm of real, certainly in her era, of people being confused or possibly disgusted by her choices.
There's a great clarification in that book, isn't there? I think I remember the first time I read Conundrum and was so, I'm not sure quite what I was expecting, but yes, maybe something that was sort of muddier or murkier, or somebody who'd had a real torturous time in working out how to go about what they wanted to work out their own identity. But there is such a clarification in her mind from, like you say, from such an early age. And it's written with such grace and kindness, I think is completely right. She talks a lot about other people's kindness towards her, but you can also tell, you get the sense that she's clearly an incredibly kind person herself, right?
Very much so. And I love that. I love kindness when I find it, and the generosity of her descriptions of others. And I love the way she does grapple with what does it mean to be a woman. And comes up with this idea of it's a spiritual, for her, it was a spiritual identity, not physical, not a mental construct, but a part of her soul. And it was just refreshing to read someone who was willing to express herself at that level, that this is who I am. This is what I believe. About my identity. It's my soul, it's my spirit.
Yes, that's true, isn't it? She does know that, and she seems to understand it. She's able to kind of talk about it on the page in such a clear way that then I feel like I understand almost effortlessly how she is feeling, because it makes perfect sense. She's able to articulate it in such a sort of clear manner.
Yes, her writing is so clear and so elegant, and just I loved it.
Yeah, and I think the other thing I do really love about that that memoir as well is just the love story between her and her wife. I think is just, I mean, the idea that they stayed together for years, and she talks so beautifully and sort of fondly about the connection they shared and the joy they bring each other. It's rare to find such a wonderful relationship written about on the page, I think.
That's right. Absolutely. It just totally transcending any of these petty ideas of your physical self, that they were connected and their parenting, their family was so important to them.
Yes, yes, exactly. Oh, gosh. Well, you've made me want to read, you made me want to go back to Conundrum, but also to read her most recent book, Allegorizings, which I think I have a copy of somewhere, so I must go and look that out. Thank you so much, Claire. It's been a real pleasure talking to you today.
I'm delighted, Lucy. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for taking the time. Thank you, everyone else, for listening. Our Shelves is brought to you by the team at Virago Press. Special thanks to today's guest, Claire Oshetsky, and tune in next time for more conversation about books, feminism, and culture.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.